Chapter 7, Marrakesh. Travel is telling the way different people like to pack and plan, or how early they leave for the airport. I've traveled so frequently for work that I've developed my own tried-and-true routine. I'm a proud member of the Too Early Club. I leave loads of time. TSA pre-check, shoes stay on, headphones in, Hudson News for snacks and a bottle of water, and then a leisurely stroll. Maybe I'll read a book while I'm waiting to board. The alternative is stressful to me, rushing in, carsick from a speeding cab, cutting in line and jogging the umpteen miles to the gate. No, thank you. That sort of intensity makes me more vulnerable to the rudeness and bad moods of strangers in airports. And people can become unhinged in airports. Stress does funny things. So I hide in my little bubble, going at my own speed. I wanted to leave for JFK on my own that Friday evening. Anna's habitual tardiness was more than I could handle. I'd heard her talk one too many times about the 6-minute helicopter flight that she could take as a last resort if she were too late for a car. That kind of stress was unappealing to me, as was the unnecessary expense. Although, as Anna put it, one day her time would be so valuable that taking a $700 chopper ride would be more cost-effective than wasting an hour in traffic. As for me, I'd rather leave wildly early and take the subway than rush and take a helicopter. "I may leave for the airport quite early so I can finish work when I get there," I told Anna. "Okay, let's go together," she replied. It was a nice try anyway. I went home to finish packing and told Anna that I'd pick her up around 7, thinking that if I booked the car, we were more likely to stay on schedule. Of course, it wasn't that easy. Anna had been butting heads with the management at 11 Howard for days. They had asked her to start paying for her reservations in advance, and she was infuriated by this irregular treatment. "No one else must do that," she had complained. Her retaliation was twofold. First, she canceled her upcoming bookings. Then, having made note of the general manager's names, she proudly declared that she had purchased the corresponding internet domains. She sent me a text around 5 p.m. "Fucking assholes," she complained. Without a reservation, 11 Howard was now refusing to store Anna's belongings. "Will the Mercer let you?" I asked. "Yes," she said. "Booked a month at Mercer. Fuck them." We would pack up all of Anna's stuff and drop it at the Mercer en route to the airport. We made plans to meet at 11 Howard around 7 p.m., but when the time came, Anna was busy getting her hair done. I needed an extra half an hour to pack anyway, so it made no difference to me. Beneath my open suitcase and a mess of clothing, my bed was hardly visible. I took stock of each garment as I folded it. Pajamas, stuff to wear with a bathing suit, shorts and pants, tops and dresses. Once my large suitcase was zipped, I would go through a similar process for my carry-on. I was tugging a mini roller bag down from the deepest corner of my crowded closet when I got another text from Anna. "Shall I email them I bought their domains or not yet?" she asked. "I wouldn't do that yet," I replied. I had tried to talk Anna out of buying the domains in the first place. Real estate developer A.B. Rosen owned 11 Howard, along with the building that Anna wanted to lease for her foundation. If the managers told him about Anna's bullying tactics, it wouldn't be a good look. But Anna had insisted that A.B. would condone, maybe even applaud, her behavior. Without sincere interest in my opinion, she had done exactly as she pleased. "Why not?" she asked. "It's a bit much. Don't they have a relationship with the Mercer? I just don't want them to talk shit about you before you get there and settled and meet people for yourself." Her spitefulness was excessive. I was trying to talk her out of it by pointing to potential consequences. "No, it's Andre Balazs' hotel," she argued. "There is no shit to be talked about me. I didn't do anything." "I only mean that you bought their domains," I explained. "It's not illegal to buy anyone's domains. I didn't publish anything on them yet." It was pointless arguing. "How would you tell them?" I asked. "Email each of them the screenshot of ownership. I'm never going to do anything with them. I like the idea of them knowing that I might." When I pulled up to 11 Howard, Anna wasn't back yet, so I waited in my Uber. "I will get the big car, so come out of yours and we'll switch everything to mine," she said. "My car is pretty big. Want to just stay in this one? It's an SUV," I answered, conscious of the time. "Okay, if you don't mind circling around," she said. "Can add the cost to my invoice." 30 minutes later, there was still no sign of Anna. With every passing minute, my anxiety increased. She asked me to have the bellhops load her bags, which I was glad to do since it would hurry things along. I exited the vehicle and orchestrated the packing as she'd requested. Two gold suitcases and bags from Net-a-Porter would come with us. The rolling rack and a large cardboard box would stay behind. When it was all done, Anna came scurrying down Howard Street, shuffling faster than a walk, slower than a jog. Her freshly blown out hair billowed as she moved. Our SUV soon hummed along the cobblestones of Crosby Street. The bellhops at the Mercer helped us offload Anna's bags and checked them to store until her return. Our errand complete, we climbed back into the car and set off for JFK. It felt like a small miracle that I'd overcome the luggage obstacle and gotten Anna into the car, not as early as hoped, but early enough to still be on time. I had always imagined that getting out the door, away from our busy Manhattan lives, would be the hardest part, and now we had done it. All that was left was to enjoy the journey, and we were ready. 2 hours before our flight, we were Marrakesh bound. Casey arrived at the airport first and went through security on her own. Jesse was waiting for Anna and me at the entrance to Terminal 5. I gave him a hug. The three of us gossiped and cracked jokes as we stood in the check-in line together. When we reached the front, I went first, on my own. The agent took my passport with a warm smile. We made small talk as she clicked away at her keyboard. To my pleasant surprise, she turned a blind eye to my overweight checked bag, sparing me a hefty fine. I thanked her and then joined Anna and Jesse, who were checking in together with another agent. Jesse was a seasoned freelancer, so from the outset, he expected Anna to pay for his expenses, including the cost of checking his gear. But there was a hiccup in the process. Although she had her passport in hand, Anna had mistakenly checked her black clutch, the one containing her credit cards. She turned to me, since she already owed me money, and asked if I'd mind covering the $200 cost for now. As she was paying for the trip, of course I didn't mind. It was a relatively small favor to ask. Until Anna could recover her clutch, this pattern would continue. I paid $120 for sushi in JFK and $80 for lunch during the layover in Lisbon. Finally, we landed in Morocco. It was Saturday, May 13th. Marrakesh Manira Airport was crowded, but La Mamounia had arranged for VIP airport assistance. Two men in coffee brown uniforms met us at our arrival gate and led us through an expedited immigrations process. They left us before the baggage area, where the four of us collected our checked belongings and made our way to customs. The line was so long that we stood for a moment looking for its end. That's when Anna did something peculiar. She walked ahead, disassociating from our group as though she had arrived in Morocco alone. She moved briskly to the front of the line, and then she slipped right through, leaving the rest of us behind. When we realized she was wandering off, we called her name and followed in her direction. But the guards took notice of us somehow, not her, and blocked our way, directing us to the end of the queue. Anna looked back as though she hadn't realized what was happening, and then her face broke into a smile. Given the length of the line the rest of us had to wait in, I understood why she had decided to test her luck. But I also realized, in a small but significant way, that Anna did not operate with a one-for-all and all-for-one mentality. She was on her own. Had she been like this in New York, too? It certainly wasn't out of character, but it struck me differently now that we were so far from home. We reconvened on the other side of the checkpoint in a large terminal with white walls and a ceiling that reminded me of the latticed foam sleeves that sometimes come on bottles of wine or shipped fruit. A driver met us there. We followed him outside, into the dry, warm air where two Land Rovers were waiting. Anna and I rode in one car, Casey and Jesse in the other. After a 10-minute drive, we pulled up to a palatial compound and entered through its gates. At the front entrance, we were welcomed by a host of men wearing fez hats and traditional Moroccan attire. We had arrived at our singularly opulent destination. Miss Delvey, our host, opted for a tour of the grounds for her and her guests. We proceeded directly, not having any need for keys or a traditional check-in procedure, since our villa was staffed with a full-time butler and, according to Anna, all billing had been settled in advance. Our private riad was the size of a small house, and our butler, a nice man named Adid, met us at the front door. We entered through a foyer, then walked down three steps into the center of an elegant living room with a Zellige tile floor. There was a seating area to our left containing a sofa, two chairs, and two ottomans upholstered in saffron gold velvet brocade. To our right was a dining space, anchored by a round, dark wooden table, on top of which white roses, chilled wine, and an assortment of fruits and pastries awaited us. Two of the Riad's bedrooms were directly off the living room. Casey took the room to the left, through a doorway in the seating area. Jesse claimed the room to the right, through a door in the dining space. There was another door to the right of the dining space, leading to a long, dark hallway with crimson walls and a carved cedar wood ceiling. The corridor turned left and ran behind the living room, past Jesse's room, to a master suite, featuring a private drawing room, a fireplace and desk, and the Riad's largest bedroom. I shared the suite with Anna. All three bedrooms had doors that opened directly onto the patio, where we could take a dip in the villa's private pool, sunbathe in a lounge chair, or pass through an ornate wrought iron gate into the resort's idyllic gardens. The hotel had four restaurants: French, Moroccan, Italian, and the pool pavilion. As it was our first night in Marrakesh, we opted for Moroccan. We sat at an outdoor table and kicked off the night and our vacation with a round of Aperol spritzes and a bottle of dry white wine. The four of us had the satisfied glow of freshly arrived travelers. Each of us brought something different to the group. Vacation mode Casey was sporting colorfully patterned pants, a white silk blouse, and an energetic smile. She was vocal about her excitement at being in such a luxurious place, but her enthusiasm stayed within measure. She seemed invested in our discussion of possible group activities, going to the souk and the Jardin Majorelle, for instance, but also content to do her own thing, which I would come to find out meant lounging by the pool. Upbeat but always balanced, Casey was our ballast. Jesse was wearing a light blue Oxford shirt and dark pants, his long hair tied into a messy high bun. He played the role of amused observer, regardless of whether or not he had his video camera in hand, which he usually did. In conversation, he would often chime in with facts, stories, and opinions. He would have the idea to make a day trip to the Atlas Mountains, for example, because he'd done some research and spoken to a friend. Jesse ruled with his intellect. At times, he inclined toward cynicism. He would confide in me with his observations or complaints, but after voicing them, he was usually quick to let them go. He and I sometimes fought like siblings. The rigidity of his opinions could make me crazy, and my occasional tendency to rule with emotion over logic could drive him nuts. Anna Delvey, international woman of whimsy and mystery, was wearing head-to-toe black, as was her norm. Black skinny jeans, a black shirt, and her feathery black coat draped over her shoulders. It was as though she had summoned us, and now that we were all here, it gave her pleasure to sit back and watch. She giggled mockingly as we processed the fanciness of our surroundings. She was just as jubilant and wide-eyed as the rest of us, only she was much faster at making herself at home. Above all else, and at this first dinner especially, Anna looked happy. Me? I filled in the seams, gluing the group together and doing my best to please. Sitting at dinner in the cool night air, I wore an irrepressible smile. I was surrounded by people whose company I enjoyed, in a country I'd never been to, in a hotel grander and more extraordinary than anything I could have imagined. I was invested in making sure that others felt as happy as I did, both in this moment and throughout the trip. A funny thing happened during our meal. One cat at first, and then another, appeared on the restaurant's terrace and moseyed over to our table. Marrakesh is filled with feral cats, so their presence wasn't a mystery. But both of them came right up to me, only me, and stared until I gave them some food, which of course I did because I couldn't help myself. Cats would single me out for the rest of the week wherever we went. It became a running joke that I was their master. So maybe that was my role, pleaser of people and of stray cats. After the boozy meal on the heels of our travel day, we returned to the villa feeling tipsy. Casey turned in for the night while Anna, Jesse, and I hung around. I think it was Anna who first decided to get in the pool. In a city roughly 1,500 feet above sea level, the evening air was chilly. Despite the thick sweater I'd worn to dinner, I'd shivered on the walk across the gardens back to our Riad. I had no interest in a swim, but Jesse gamely joined our host. Anna's music played from a speaker in the courtyard while they swam. Meanwhile, I crawled under the covers in the master bedroom to get warm. Minutes later, I heard Anna's voice. "Let's get Rachel to come in the pool, too." Not happening, I thought. I'm a miserable person when I'm cold. I hate it. Dinner had been fun, I was in a good mood, but I really, really did not want to get in the pool. Not for all the tea in China. No way, no how. I don't remember the exact sequence of events, but I do remember being chased. It was only Anna at first. She came toward me with a mischievous sparkle in her eye, which was enough to make me run. I darted around the bedroom, down the long hallway, through the living room, the courtyard, and past the pool. At first, I tried to laugh off what was happening, but as the chase continued, I could feel myself getting mad. "I mean it," I yelled. "I am not in the mood." With Anna running after me, I sought refuge through the rear door back in our room. When I leaped onto the bed, she followed. I remember her grabbing my wrists. We tussled. She was laughing. I was not. I can still picture the look on her face when she realized that I was stronger than she was. I broke free from her grasp, rolled away, and kept running. At some point, Jesse joined in the pursuit. I would not let them pull me in. If it was going to happen, I would do it myself. I made a dash for my suitcase, threw on a bathing suit, marched to the pool, and jumped in without hesitation, pulling myself out just as quickly. "There. Are you happy?" I said. They cheered. Dripping in cold, I stormed off. Okay, I know. Poor me, right? Chased by two friends who only wanted me to get in the pool of our private villa on the grounds of one of the world's nicest hotels. But alone in the bedroom, I was so hot with anger that tears burned in my eyes. Sure, we were all a little drunk. And so what? The stakes were low. Anna and Jesse? Only horsing around. But they had inadvertently hit upon one of my trigger points. I gave Anna so much leeway. I abided her bossiness, her rudeness, and her lack of boundaries. This was one thing I had said clearly. I did not want to get in the pool. Why couldn't she let me have that? Not only did she override my agency, she sucked Jesse in too, using my friend against me. Anna knew that I was serious, and still, she hunted me for sport. I felt bullied, alone, and sorry I'd come. I sent Jesse a text message and an email just to be sure he got the point. "Please do not gang up on me with Anna. It's not fun. I do not find it amusing." He responded within minutes to say that he was sorry and that it wouldn't happen again. Just before I put down my cell phone to go to sleep, Anna walked into the bedroom looking sheepish, her head lowered and eyes raised. I glanced up from my phone just long enough to make eye contact before looking back down. For a minute, there was silence as she walked into the bathroom to change. When she re-entered the room, she ventured a few words. "You were really mad, huh?" she said, her tone soft. "Yeah," I answered. I waited a beat before adding, "That was not fun." "I'm really sorry we got carried away," she said. I felt something tight within my chest begin to loosen. "It's okay," I replied. There was a pause. "I've never seen you get that angry." To my surprise, I felt myself begin to smile, and then laugh. Anna started to laugh with me. By the time I fell asleep, the air had cleared. The next morning, I decided to put the incident behind me. We had drunk too much wine, were overtired, and I'd no doubt overreacted as a result. Moving forward, I would make an effort to be less uptight. Anna took a private tennis lesson in the morning. We met her afterward for breakfast at the poolside buffet. We would spend the rest of the day exploring all that La Mamuña had to offer. We roamed the extensive gardens and relaxed in the hammam, a Moroccan steam room. Between adventures, Adid appeared, as if by magic, with fresh watermelon and chilled bottles of rosé. We luxuriated in the hazy bliss of a day without obligations. Lounging in the sun, we lost track of time. When we were hungry, we ate. When we were tired, we napped. By day's end, we were fully relaxed and all getting along. Early the next morning, we did a workout with Casey. Thankfully, we had the gym to ourselves. Jesse was there with his camera, and while Anna may have liked for others to see her being filmed, I was reluctant. Afterward, Anna and Casey both took a nap. That afternoon, we decided to go for a walk around Marrakesh. We all agreed that La Mamuña was beautiful, but at this point, we were ready to venture out. Anna wanted two things: piles of spices worthy of an Instagram photo and a place to buy some caftans. La Mamuña's concierge arranged everything, and within minutes we had a tour guide and set off with a car and driver. Our van came to a stop and we stepped out one by one, fresh from our sheltered resort life into the dusty warmth of the mysterious maze known as the Medina, an ancient walled metropolis. The tour guide knew what our priorities were. Nevertheless, he made an unscheduled stop at an antique store on the way. Next came the rug shop, which was something we'd wanted to see. Drinking hot tea, as was the custom, we sat on a couch and watched the workers unroll their wares. Anna got on her knees to feel the texture of a one-of-a-kind hand-knotted wool rug made by the Berber tribes of the Middle Atlas Mountains. Quietly, she said to me, "I'll buy you one if you want it." The rugs cost thousands of dollars. It was a generous offer, typical of Anna. I thanked her, but passed. After finishing our tea, we moved on. We were quite a sight, walking through the narrow alleyways of the marketplace, led by our tour guide, a chatty, round-faced man in blue jeans and a baseball cap. Casey trailed a few steps behind him, dressed in all white and carrying a blue woven tote bag in her left hand. Anna walked beside her in a coral-colored dress that tied behind her neck, leaving her arms and upper back exposed. Her sunglasses were on top of her head, and she carried the black clutch that she'd accidentally checked when we were leaving New York. Then there was Jesse, wearing a backpack, floating behind Casey and Anna with his video camera lifted in front of his face. I walked behind everyone, stopping here and there to photograph alleyways with my phone. No one spoke much as we wandered. We were too busy marveling at the mystical people and places that surrounded us. "Can you make this dress, but with black linen?" Anna asked a woman in Le Maison du Caftan Moroccan. Before the woman could reply, Anna continued, "I'll take one in black and one in white linen, and Rachel, I'd love to get one for you." I scanned the store's racks as Anna tried on a bright red jumpsuit and a range of gauzy sheer dresses. I tried on a few things too, but wary of the iffy fabric content and high prices, I soon joined Jesse and Casey in the shop's seating area for glasses of mint tea. When Anna went to pay, her debit card was declined. "Did you tell your banks that you were traveling?" I asked. "No," was her reply. In that case, I wasn't surprised that such a purchase would be flagged. Anna asked to borrow the money, promising to reimburse me the following week. I agreed and charged the $1,339.24 purchase to my credit card, careful to keep track of the receipt. We wandered around until dusk. Then we went directly to La Sultana, a 5-star luxury hotel nestled within the Medina, where we sat on the rooftop terrace, bathed in lantern light and the mesmerizing sound of the Islamic call to prayer echoing from minarets across the Red City. Pleased with our expedition, we ate dinner in high spirits. I paid for that too, adding it to my tab with Anna. When we got back to our resort, we stopped for a drink in the Churchill Bar within La Mamunia's main building. We were talking about what else we could do that evening when someone mentioned the hotel's grand casino. "I've never been to a casino," I said. That sealed the deal. We finished our drinks and walked straight over. We stayed only a short while, but within that time, Anna helped me play roulette, explaining how it worked as she stood by my side. But my favorite game was the slot machines, and they seemed to like me too. I won a little money in a lucky streak and then lost it just as fast. We left when I ran out of cash, all of it except for one chip, which I held onto as a keepsake. That night in the Riad, Anna and Jesse got back in the pool. Jesse shot video while Anna swam around wearing a black dress that she'd gotten in the Medina. Eminem's Rhyme or Reason played in the background. Anna was deliberate with her poses. She lifted her dress so it floated around her, revealing her legs. The performance was artificially sensuous. She was playing to the camera, clearly loving its attention and grinning nonstop. Casey wasn't feeling well. She had a stomachache that started on Monday afternoon, so when it was time for our first outing on Tuesday, she stayed behind in the villa to rest. Anna, Jesse, and I were heading to the Jardin Majorelle. The hotel booked our car and driver, the same tour guide from the previous day. We were walking through the lobby to meet them when a hotel employee waved Anna to a stop. "Miss Delvey, may we speak with you?" he said, tactfully pulling her aside. "Is everything okay?" I asked when she rejoined the group. "Yes," Anna reassured me. "I just need to call my bank." Anna wore her new red jumpsuit that day in the hope that it would photograph well. Jesse shot video and I snapped a few pictures as we walked together through the garden. We went from there to lunch at a poolside restaurant in the Darras Lane Hotel. After a successful search for photogenic spices, which we found in the Mala, the city's Jewish quarter, we returned to La Mamunia, contented. We were walking out of the lobby toward our Riad when a hotel employee approached Anna once again. She quelled his concern with assurances. "Okay, I'll just need to call my bank. It's because of the way you're trying to run the card over and over." Then we carried on with our day. La Mamunia is surrounded by an ochre-colored perimeter wall, part of the city's 12th-century ramparts. We were walking along its bougainvillea-covered interior when Anna approached a guard at the entrance nearest our riad. "Can you tell us, is there a way to get on the wall?" she asked. At first, I thought I'd misunderstood her, but she asked again, trying to explain that she wanted a way to be on top of the wall. The question was nonsensical, as was the idea. The wall was high and narrow. There were no ladders or platforms in sight. Moreover, the top of the wall was uneven. If Anna somehow managed to get up there, she wouldn't be able to sit. Standing back, I watched the interaction with bemusement. When the guard looked to me for a translation, I shrugged and shook my head. Either Anna was suffering from confusion, faced with something impossible but looking for a loophole, or she was asking the question for the sake of entertainment. I wagered the latter and stood transfixed. On Wednesday morning, en route to breakfast, I was also stopped as I passed through the lobby. "Miss Williams, have you seen Miss Delvey?" When I joined the others at the poolside restaurant, I told Anna that the front desk wanted to see her. She was agitated by the inconvenience. You could always tell when Anna was agitated. She made almost comically huffy noises. "Ugh, why?" and typed furiously on her phone. She left the villa and came back shortly after, ostensibly relieved that the situation was being resolved. Not long after, Anna, Jessie, and I were in the back of a van drinking a bottle of rosé on two bench seats facing each other, speeding through the desert toward the mountains. Casey, still feeling ill, had stayed in bed for the second day in a row. As usual, Anna blasted music as loud as her phone would allow. An hour later, we arrived at Sir Richard Branson's Cospitomato, a destination hotel with only 28 guest rooms, situated in the remote foothills of the High Atlas Mountains. We'd come for lunch. The hotel radiated a serene energy as its inhabitants lounged in the breeze, which was fitting since Cospitomato means soft breeze in the language of the Berbers, an indigenous people of North Africa. We sat around a table on the terrace, absorbing a sweeping view of the adjacent valley and mountains before studying the food and drink menus, bound in beautiful handwoven casings. Anna and I ordered mojitos to start. Jessie went for a mimosa. The table would soon become a medley of flavor and color. We sipped Perrier from vibrant orange glasses and ate freshly baked Berber bread dipped in rich local olive oil. At some point, we switched to white wine. My vegetable tagine arrived so sizzling hot that I made Anna and Jessie look to see how it was bubbling. Not wanting the meal to end, we ordered dessert, raspberry and lemon sorbet, an eaten mess, and a round of espressos. The bill came to $236.24, which once again I paid. After lunch, Anna asked the front desk for a tour. We saw a sampling of the hotel's 28 bedrooms, from suites to Berber tents, each decorated in a unique style blending traditional Moroccan furnishings with antiques from all over the world. We passed by the turquoise swimming pool, the property's centerpiece, and, at Anna's urging, we strolled through the fragrant manicured gardens to see the two tennis courts located within the greenery. I couldn't tell if Anna was acting interested just for fun, if she was doing research for her foundation, or if she was sincerely curious. She toyed with the idea of making a reservation for the following week, but dropped the discussion when I reminded her that I was leaving for France. Back in Marrakesh, we went directly from our excursion to Daryakout, a restaurant situated within a former medieval home, where we began the evening with a glass of wine on the roof. Beneath a cobalt blue sky, Nawa musicians in bright red costumes sat cross-legged on a rug, playing their instruments for a crowd of appreciative listeners, many of whom took photos and videos like Anna, Jessie, and I did. We were exuberant. Anna especially looked joyful, maybe the most relaxed I'd seen her during the whole trip. She and Jessie had struck up a nice rapport, each making comments and jokes to make the other laugh. All three of us, in fact, were getting along very well. Once that silly drama from the first night passed, it had been smooth sailing. Dinner at Daryakout was a drawn-out and heavy affair, a luxurious five-course feast with huge serving sizes and plenty of wine. We sat in a salon tucked within a cushioned booth, with a view of the courtyard and tables scattered with rose petals all around us. The meal went on for ages. It was the type of rich food and the type of cozy place that makes you feel almost too relaxed to remain in public. Once we finally finished, we decided to relocate to the courtyard for tea before calling it a night. I can't remember anything we talked about, but I do recall laughing about the day and feeling glad that we'd gotten to cover so much ground, driving through the Atlas Mountains, seeing Cospitomato, and now eating in this over-the-top restaurant. The vacation hadn't been quite what I expected. We'd had fewer activities planned than I had imagined, and we were working without almost any structure. But looking back on it now, I felt lucky to be there, a jillion miles from home, and filled with gratitude to Anna for having invited me. It was late when we got back to La Mamuña. We entered through the hotel's main lobby, and immediately two managers stepped forward. They pulled Anna aside, and she sat down to make a call while Jesse and I lingered awkwardly nearby. At first, neither Jesse nor I paid the situation much mind, but as we stood there, the hotel employees around us were growing visibly flustered. Jesse began to talk with one of them. I couldn't hear the conversation, but Jesse later told me that someone had been fired because of the trouble with our villa's payment. After about a minute, Anna, who was out of earshot but appeared to be speaking clipped phrases into her cell phone, began walking through the lobby in the direction of our riad. Jesse and I followed. So did the two managers, who, once inside our villa, stopped ominously on the edge of our living room. I offered them chairs, but they declined. Anna sat in front of them, intensely focused. I excused myself and went to bed, acutely embarrassed and sure there was nothing I could do anyway. The next day was when it all went wrong. A panicked morning that turned into the perfect storm. The hotel managers in the living room demanding a card. Me caving to the pressure and giving them mine. When I packed my bags and climbed into bed that night, I was hoping to leave before Anna got up. But the next morning, she woke up when I did. She floated behind me like a sleepwalker while I gathered the last of my belongings. Trying to put some distance between us, I rolled my suitcase into the living room and went out into the courtyard where Adid brought a plate of fruit and some coffee. Soon, Jesse emerged from his room, groggy and shirtless, and the three of us sat around the table, Anna with her legs crossed, tugging at a hangnail with her teeth, while Jesse was perched over his phone. No one said much. Like kids after a stay at summer camp that had lasted just a little too long, we were ready to go. "Don't have any fun without me," I said to Anna and Jesse as I passed my suitcase to the driver in front of our riad. Jesse hugged me. I hugged Anna. "Thank you so much," I said to her. Goodbyes were exchanged, and I climbed into the back seat. Looking out at Anna and Jesse, I made a sad face, showing how sorry I was to leave. In truth, I was relieved to be saying goodbye after the chaotic and stressful billing situation that had occurred, but I was also grateful to Anna for inviting me on such a lavish vacation. I had enjoyed a lot of the trip, the luxurious riad, the incredible meals, the private guides. It was an extremely generous gift, and I viewed it as such. At this point, I thought that Anna would pay the hotel bill when she checked out, and, worst-case scenario, if the charge on my personal card were to stay there, without a credit for the same amount as the hotel promised, Anna would repay me the following week when she wired reimbursement for the flights and expenses from outside the hotel. This was not an arrangement I had agreed to in advance, but considering the way things had played out, it felt as though I had no choice but to go along with it. Sure, I was annoyed by Anna's cavalier disregard for logistics, but this was just how she was, how she had always been. A rich girl disconnected from the mundane stressors of monthly billing cycles, who'd gone on an expensive vacation and not told her parents, who'd blown through her allowance and been forced to stall for time, who'd backed herself into a corner but could easily sort things out. And I trusted that she would. I believed in her. Chapter 8. Reprieve. Eager to leave Anna and the riad behind, I arrived at the airport early, checked in, and flew through security. I used my downtime to write two postcards featuring pictures of camels in the desert, mementos from Morocco, one to Nick and one to my parents. They were handwritten highlight reels. "Hello, isn't this card cute? I love you. See you soon." Neither included any mention of Anna. Lacking postage stamps, I slid the postcards into the book I was reading, White Teeth by Zadie Smith, and went on my way. I had taken 2 whole weeks off from my job at VF, a record for me since vacation days were scarce, and there was rarely a good time to be away from the office. Print magazines operate on a relentless cycle. It had felt like a stroke of luck to find this window in mid-May. I would go from Morocco to Nice, where I planned to rent a car, and drive through Provence before meeting colleagues for the Annie Leibovitz opening in Arles. When I touched down in Nice, I switched on my cell phone and immediately received a text from Anna. It was the day that she and Jesse had originally planned to return to New York. I say planned because Anna had kept her itinerary flexible by design, booking only one-way flights to Morocco so that her return travel could be decided at a later date. "I'll deal with return flights later," she had texted. She eventually chose to extend her trip by a few days to stay at Caspitomato, the resort that we'd visited earlier in the week. Jesse, who was relying on Anna for his flight home, was along for the ride. It was from the Atlas Mountains that Anna was texting me. "I'm catching up on emails now. We'll forward you your confirmation as soon as I get it," she assured me. She then told me that before she left La Mamounia, the tall manager had stopped by our Riad one more time. "I gave him your contact. He said he'd like to email a thank you note," Anna said. I puzzled over this statement for a good 2 minutes before her next text arrived. "Will you rather have the whole total wired to your Chase bank account and you decide what you want to take off your Amex? That way you can email them directly with all instructions?" This question didn't make sense. Email who with instructions? Of course I wanted Anna to wire the money to my checking account. Was it even possible to wire money directly to American Express? Yes, maybe, but the idea confused me. I'd already sent her my bank account details, along with an itemization of expenses. "Yes, whole bill wired to Chase is best, thank you so much," I replied. "I'll just apply it separately to the Amex." She seemed to understand. "That way you can decide what works best for you and also get all points," she reasoned, incentivizing the transaction with her mention of Amex reward points. Another text quickly followed. "Thanks again for stepping in, greatly appreciated." It was then I understood that Anna intended to apply the full hotel bill to my account, to add it to the total she owed me from expenses we incurred outside the hotel. I wasn't sure how that would work. I didn't think it was actually possible. How had she left La Mamounia? And how did she check into another hotel? I sent 3 texts in rapid fire. "I don't know if the whole bill will go through. You're welcome, thank you for the trip. Just hoping we can get the wire, etc. sorted today because I'm nervous about my cards not working for the weekend. Sorry to be a bother." It seemed like a foregone conclusion that the entire hotel bill would be on my credit card. We were both already gone from La Mamounia, but I trusted Anna to reimburse me as she'd promised. What else could I do? "I'll wire you $70,000, that way everything's covered," she wrote. That was more money than I made in a year. "Thank you so much, Anna," I replied. Minutes later, she copied me on an email to the hotel. "Following up on my last email, can you please send me the total bill and the summary of all charges that have been put on Rachel's card? Appreciate your assistance. Rachel was nice enough to provide you her card, but it's my responsibility to make sure all parties are covered. Looking forward to receiving it before the EOD today. Thanks, AD." Even though I'd never been to the south of France before, it felt familiar and welcoming. My Aunt Jenny, my mom's oldest sister, a world traveler and fellow Francophile, had given me recommendations that I'd dutifully recorded and mapped out. I'd picked a route, booked a rental car in advance and lodging for each night, and loosely planned for each day, leaving ample room to wander. I settled into a small guest room at Hotel Nice Beau Rivage, which was simple but lovely and in a great location, only a block from the sea and a short walk from the city's charming old town. Since I had only one evening and morning scheduled in Nice, I rested briefly after my arrival before setting out to explore. The narrow roads were lined with colorful storefronts, drenched in the yellow of the warm evening sun. I carried a camera around my neck and with it a sense of purpose. Taking pictures was an activity that I could do alone, which encouraged me to take in and engage with my surroundings. Over the course of the day, Anna kept in touch via text message. During the night, she sent an update on the wire transfer. "I've initiated everything today. We'll forward you the FedRef, federal reference number used for tracking wire transfers, as soon as they email it to me. Hope you're having fun." The next day was the third Saturday in May, a market day. The sky was clear blue and the air was cool in the shade. I left the hotel early to revisit the old town for breakfast and to explore the open-air antique market in Place Garibaldi. I admired the furniture and bric-a-brac, content to collect photos in lieu of things. My time in France was quickly becoming the opposite of my time in Morocco. Modest lodgings and full cultural immersion replaced the decadence of La Mamounia, and and the lack of meaningful exploration. Marrakesh was already feeling far away and long ago. As checkout time approached, I made my way back to the hotel through the Promenade du Paillon, a park that separated the newer parts of Nice from the historic old town. Along the walkway, geysers erupted at seemingly random intervals, spouts of water that shot upward, sometimes high, sometimes low. Drenched children dashed through and around the fountains, testing their bravery and trilling with laughter. The wire with my reimbursement had been initiated, Anna said. I only needed to wait. But at the front desk of Hotel Nice Beau Rivage, I was abruptly reminded of my financial strain. American Express had raised my limit just enough for me to safely leave Morocco, but when I tried to use my credit card in Nice, it wouldn't go through. Fortunately, the day prior had been a Condé Nast payday, so I'd received 2 weeks' salary via direct deposit into my checking account, as usual. I used it to pay for the hotel. I collected my suitcase from the front desk and went outside for a taxi. I sent a text to Anna. Hi, Anna, my Amex isn't working. I have enough cash for the weekend, but hoping the wire can be processed on Monday so I'm able to make a payment to Amex. Pause. I hope you guys are off riding donkeys. It should be credited on Monday, first half of the day, she replied. A relief. I took a taxi to pick up my rental car. I'd never driven a car abroad before, but I tried not to overthink it. At least in France, they drove on the same side of the street as in the U.S. Driving was calming and intuitive, and I made good time to Aix-en-Provence, where I spent the first part of my day just wandering around. Then I drove 10 minutes north to Paul Cézanne's art studio, Atelier de Louvre, where I was excited to see the light, landscapes, and vignettes that inspired a painter I'd admired since childhood. The furniture in his studio was pushed to the perimeter, where it supported still-life subjects, skulls, bowls, fruit, and canvases arranged in familiar tableau. It was a pleasant but odd experience to see behind the curtain of his paintings. Cézanne's studio felt almost quaint compared with the artistic magnitude of his work. Afterward, I drove another 20 minutes north to Château Lacoste, where I traipsed along winding paths toward two art exhibitions and rambled through a sculpture garden. The grounds were modern and imposing after the more subdued elegance of Cézanne's atelier. I arrived at Lormoran just before dinner, pausing as I neared the walled village to photograph fields of poppies set afire by the afternoon sun. A man named Adam, about my age, checked me in for a two-night stay at Le Moulin de Lormoran, an olive oil mill from the 18th century that had been converted to a boutique hotel. Early the next morning, I walked a short way to the Cimetière de Lormoran, taking photographs as I passed through town. The outing felt appropriate for a Sunday morning, and I went through the motions with a certain spiritualism, thinking of Patti Smith and her pilgrimages to sacred old places. I circled the small cemetery twice before finding Albert Camus' austere grave, set within a small plot of fading daffodils. At 10 o'clock the next morning, my phone buzzed with a text from Anna. "Hope you are good," she said. "We'll make sure the wire gets settled today." Like clockwork, she chimed in with an update before I'd even asked. Thanks you, I replied. I departed Lormoran for a day packed with activities. I perused a market in Lory, marveled at the views of Bagneux, toured a monastery in Gourde, retraced Aunt Jenny's footsteps in Venosque, where she'd once rented a house, and at last arrived in Villeneuve-les-Avignon. My hotel for the night was the fanciest I'd booked, Le Prieuré, a relais and chateau property that had been converted from an old priory. I'd made the reservation through a discount website for less than $200. It was heavenly. Ancient, ivy-covered stone walls, turquoise shutters, large windows with white trim, and best of all, a cottage garden, perfect in its overgrowth. After a walk through the medieval town, I went to the hotel's restaurant for dinner. My table was outside on a terrace facing the garden, so I watched its blooms and branches like a show. Bird songs mixed with the murmur of neighboring conversations. Sunlight turned the scenery from a bright yellow-green to gold. I was spellbound and deeply glad to be there. The past few days had marked the first real vacation I'd ever taken alone, and it was drawing to a close. Even though I was staying in France for the rest of the week, I'd be with colleagues. As I sipped Côte de Rhône between bites of cheese, I felt pleased with the decisions I'd made and the sights I'd seen, and proud of my self-sufficiency. The day ended just as it began with a series of text messages from Anna. 1. hey, 2, all good, 3, let me know once you see the wire from your side, hope it didn't cause you too much trouble this weekend. I checked my bank account, nothing. Hi, haven't seen it yet, maybe tomorrow. I'm good, not too much trouble, thank you, just using my debit card, but I'm at my last 1K. Meep, you guys leaving tomorrow? Yes, trying to get a helicopter to go straight to Casablanca and not have to sit in a car for 4 hours. Whoa, I replied. Getting to know local cops to get the permits, haha. Jeez, girl, you a mover and a shaker. The next morning, I returned my rental car in Avignon. My colleague Catherine and her husband Mark were picking me up in their car later that afternoon so that we could ride together to Arles, where we would share a large Airbnb. While I waited for them, I visited the Pont d'Avignon, and then walked into Avignon's centre-ville, or town center, where I spent a few hours roaming. Anna texted that afternoon, but only to complain again about Neff. Neff had bragged on Twitter about having heard The Carter Five, an unreleased Lil Wayne album that had come into the hands of Martin Shkreli, who shared some of the tracks with Anna, who in turn played them for Neff. Anna had spoken about knowing Shkreli, the infamous pharma bro, on occasion. The first time was when she had bragged about having met him over lunch at Le Cuckoo. After my meeting, all of the employees at 11 Howard were like coming up to me and saying, Anna, why are you meeting with one of the most hated men on the planet? Anna had told me. She had been annoyed by the hotel employees' nosiness. I had Martin sign an NDA. What do I need to have everyone else sign one too? She hadn't realized how many people knew who Shkreli was, nor how strongly everyone felt about him. Well, yeah, Anna, I had replied, he's a pretty notorious villain. She had been quick to defend him by arguing that he was just making decisions based on business, that he was taking advantage of the system in a way that cost insurance companies, not individual people, and that what he was doing wasn't illegal. To me, Anna's logic demonstrated that she was able to willfully separate business transactions from their moral and ethical consequences. Observing her coldness, I had supposed it was a mentality that she'd had to adopt in order to hold her own in the world of finance. I didn't agree with her, but she left me no room to argue. I told her not to mention it to anyone, Anna continued to text, venting about Neff, and she's like, of course not, I'd never. I sympathized with Anna's frustration. You're joking, I replied. It's so easy for anyone who's not completely stupid to put two and two together. Like she works at the hotel I'm staying at. What a coincidence, Anna said. Yeah, not cool. You should ask her to take it down. She's just fishing for attention, said Anna. She removed that tweet but never texted back. Ugh, what you gonna do? Forget about it, I replied. Catherine and Mark picked me up and we drove together to Arles. The trip took less than an hour. It was Tuesday evening and our return flights weren't until Saturday. The opening of the Annie Leibovitz exhibition would take place on Friday, so we had a couple of days to do as we pleased. With Catherine and Mark, I happily relaxed my producer brain's need to make plans and was content to go along with their agenda. As a group, our dynamic was much like that of a niece traveling with her aunt and uncle. What's more, they'd been to Arles before. Catherine had traveled there for photo shoots. She shared its haunts and stories, tales from the Grand Hotel Nord-Pinu, like cherished folklore, and I felt lucky to be along for the ride. I looked and listened, wide-eyed and thankful. On Wednesday morning, we went by the Luma Foundation, where Annie and her team were readying the show. The works were still being installed, but the scale was already staggering. The exhibition was entitled The Early Years, 1970 to 1983, Archive Project No. 1. More than 8,000 photographs, printed and unframed, were being pinned to freestanding walls inside an expansive industrial warehouse. The prints didn't feel precious, they felt raw, and granted intimate access to their subjects. The collective impact was astounding. Afterward, on our way to lunch at La Chassignette, a restaurant and organic farm a few miles outside of Arles, I received a text from Anna. How is it going? In Arles? She asked. Got here last night, it's good. Haven't received the wire yet. Maybe I should call Chase? Are you and Jesse still in Marrakesh? An hour passed. Mark, Catherine, and I sat in the dappled sunlight that came through La Chassignette's vine-covered trellis. We sampled wines and devoured small tasting dishes the moment they arrived at our table. Anna kept texting. I will forward you the FedRef so your bankers can track it. They called me yesterday to confirm. Perfect, thank you, I wrote back. You guys traveling today? Yes, my friends are coming for one of their wives' birthdays this weekend to Marrakesh, so I might stay a night or two longer to see them, but Jesse has to return. Friends? I'd not heard her mention them before, but I didn't give it much thought. Given my response, it was possible I'd misread her text. Bon voyage, I replied. I hope the settling into Mercer goes smoothly. Anna's texts kept arriving over the course of the afternoon. She wanted to try a new personal trainer, she said. Someone to see on days when we didn't work out with Casey. Maybe they have some empty room at Mercer that we can use for the workout, otherwise I'm not sure where. After lunch, Catherine, Mark, and I drove through the Camargue to Saint Marie de la Mer. The seaside town was filled with caravans thanks to the Jeton pilgrimage, an annual event when Romani people from across Europe come together in honor of their patron saint, Sarah Lacali, or Sarah the Black. We watched from the car as we slowly drove through. I saw bare feet on asphalt, a blend of colors and people. Eternal pilgrims on the world's roads, as Pope Paul VI is said to have called them. Back in Arles, we met up with colleagues who had gathered in anticipation of Annie Leibovitz's opening when Anna resurfaced. Jesse just left. I'm staying here till Friday night, she texted. This was good news. When I left Marrakesh, I had wondered how he and Anna would get along. In their company, my presence had often served as a buffer. Once I left for France, Jesse kept in touch with me via text message. At first, he seemed okay. He and Anna rode mules on a trek through the Atlas Mountains. He said hi to Richard Branson when he saw him on the property. Like in Marrakesh, Anna asked the hotel for private tennis lessons. Eager to accommodate her request, Cospitomato brought in a coach from La Mamounia each day. The coach became friendly with Anna, and his company outlasted their tennis lessons. He joined Jesse and Anna for dinners and a hike. I imagined a third party was good for their dynamic. But Jesse's tone quickly grew restless. FYI, Anna tried to book flights today for tomorrow. Can't book under 24 hours for U.S. flights out of here, he said. What happened? I replied. Remembering that I'd booked a flight for Casey without any issue, I wondered if he was mistaken, but assumed he'd done his research. I've been asking every day what flight we got. She just didn't buy them. I don't know why. Par for the course, amigo, I answered. It's driving me nuts inside, he said. Jesse was clearly ready to leave. He was relying on Anna for a flight home, but she kept avoiding buying a ticket. I was relieved when Anna said that he'd finally gotten out. Catherine, Mark, and I returned to our apartment. As we went about our evening, Anna kept rambling by text. She was going to stay in Morocco for a few days to celebrate the birthday of one of her developer's wives, she confirmed, and from there she would fly to Los Angeles to attend Recode's annual technology conference. Her focus ricocheted, Morocco, LA, New York. She forwarded an email from Peter Brack, who was involved in reservations at the Mercer. It confirmed her new arrival date and included information about the hotel's relationship with a nearby gym. She wanted to know if we should suggest that gym to the new personal trainer. Anna, next week three times? I think if we say we're from Mercer, they let us do anything. So I can plan Casey on other days. I forgot I might be going to California. Maybe let's start with Key, the new trainer, the week of the 5th. Unclear how tolerating he is to last-minute schedule adjustments, we don't want to throw him off from the start. I was feeling refreshed and centered after my alone time and was beginning to think that it was time to slow down my friendship with Anna. Our travels had shown me just how different we were as people, and although I still found her engaging, I was ready to give the relationship some space. I wasn't in the mood to make plans. I joined a group of friends for a late dinner, Catherine, Mark, Annie's studio manager, the executive VP of an image licensing company, and her husband. Annie stopped by briefly, too, to say hello before going to bed in preparation for tomorrow's big day. Seven of us huddled around a small table in the courtyard of Hotel de Cloître. At midnight, I heard from Jesse. He was stuck in Casablanca. He had insisted that Anna confirm his return ticket before he got into the car at Cospitomato. Despite her assurances, he arrived at the airport 4 hours later without a reservation. He was incredulous. Jesse was accustomed to traveling for photo shoots, which meant that it was usually a producer's responsibility to make sure that his travel went smoothly, to make reservations in advance, and to troubleshoot issues should they arise. He had little tolerance for poorly made plans, and it was not usually his job to be involved with fixing them. He expected days to be filled, flights to be ticketed, and hotels to be booked. Reasonable expectations, and ones that I shared. But clearly with Anna, there were no guarantees. When confronted with the mishap, Anna told Jesse that her assistant had mistakenly canceled his booking when she adjusted her plans to stay. Stranded at the airport and determined to leave, Jesse managed to book his own flight home, but by the time he bought the ticket, it was too late to board. He spiraled, venting to me as he sparred with Anna. Reading his texts, I felt sorry for him. He spent the night in a hotel. That night, unable to sleep, I checked my bank account for any sign of an incoming wire. Then I logged into American Express. The La Mamuña charges were still on my account, now totaling $36,010.09. And there were new charges, this time to my Condé Nast corporate card. Two lines from La Mamuña, which totaled $16,770.45. It was the balance of our bill, an amount the hotel had been unable to put on my now frozen personal card. Evidently, they'd kept my corporate card on file. My stomach did a somersault. If I received Anna's wire promptly, I could put the money toward payment of my corporate statement before anyone noticed. And yet, Anna was becoming increasingly unreliable. Her tone with me was unchanged, but her empty promises were cause for concern, and her treatment of Jesse was cause for dismay. In New York, Anna's flakiness and lack of attention to detail had few consequences, but in Marrakesh, it was dangerously problematic. Still, she made us feel as though we were under her umbrella. Even when I'd had to front the money, she had been physically there beside me to assure that it would all be okay. She was our generous host, after all. But letting Jesse get in a car for a 4-hour drive and stranding him at the airport without a flight or a plan was something different. I started to see Anna's behavior as negligent, and it worried me. Chapter 9. Reentry. It was Saturday, May 27th, when I flew from Marseille to New York by way of Paris. Text messaging with Anna about repayment had become part of a new routine. We took turns starting the conversation each morning. Sometimes I'd go first. "Hi, A, the wire still hasn't come through. Do you have that ref so I can call Chase to check on the status?" On other days, she'd beat me to it. "Do you see the incoming wire in your account? Still waiting in remittance letters that I'll forge you once I get it. If the wire still hasn't arrived, your banker can use it to track it." The delay weighed on my nerves, but since I had faith the funds would arrive any minute, I didn't tell anyone about it. It didn't seem necessary, and I'd always been taught that financial matters were private. If I were Anna, I'd have been embarrassed to put such a strain on a friend. By not blabbing about it to others, I was being respectful. Besides, I thought I understood Anna better than anyone else, so there wasn't much point in asking for outside input. I rationalized her delay by considering the way she often put the cart before the horse, like booking a riad before deciding who to invite, or making a dinner reservation for 4 people and then scrambling to fill the seats. Where logistics were concerned, Anna was simply ill-equipped, but somehow it always worked out. The same principle applied to sending a wire transfer. She set the plan in motion, and even if it took a while and she couldn't find the reference number, I was sure the rest would fall into place. Though the situation was stressful, I was happy to be home, reunited with my little rascal of a cat, Boo, and spending time with Nick. I also got to see my brother, Noah, who had moved to New York and was living in Grandma Marilyn's spare bedroom, a rite of passage. The first weekend after my trip, Noah's girlfriend came to town, visiting from Knoxville. We joined Nick in Brooklyn and romped around the borough together. I carried my camera and took pictures like I'd done in the south of France, pretending I was still in tourist mode. Monday was Memorial Day, so we embraced the long weekend. I continued to remain silent about my financial situation. I'd always been very private, not only about finances, but also about my feelings, so it wasn't unusual for me to keep this sort of information to myself. Although this time around, it felt like I was entering a sort of denial as I tried to shrug off the stress and keep moving forward. Anna said she was stopping by London and then going straight to Los Angeles. "No one is in NY and everything is closed for Memorial. I don't want to go to Mercer for 2 nights and be gone for the rest of the week." Coincidentally, I would also be in Los Angeles that week, on Thursday. I was to attend a site visit at the Wallace Annenberg Center in Beverly Hills to prepare for a group portrait which Annie Leibovitz would photograph in October during Vanity Fair's annual New Establishment Summit, a conference Anna once again hoped to attend. Though my scouting trip would be brief, its timing seemed convenient. If the wire hadn't arrived by then, Anna and I could meet in person to settle our accounts. And then what? Would I continue being friends with Anna? Would I fault her for relying on me when her cards weren't working? She'd been generous enough to invite me on a trip like that, I reasoned, and even though the way she'd required my help had been frustrating, there would be no lasting damage once the debt was repaid. It had always been my impulse to aid a friend in need. But the situation had pushed me to my limits. Did Anna expect me to overlook the inexplicable delay in repayment and ignore what had happened with Jesse? My feelings toward her had irreversibly changed, and I was trying to understand how. Traveling with Anna had revealed a previously undetected riskiness beneath her idiosyncratic behavior. In New York, when she tested limits, the stakes seemed low, but not in Marrakesh. Her recklessness was hard to fully excuse. When this was finally over, I would want space. Perhaps Anna and I could resume a more casual friendship after a time. I didn't want her as a close friend, but I didn't want her as an enemy either. Burning bridges was not something I ever did, and I hated the thought of having someone mad at me. It takes a lot of nerve to completely cut off a relationship. So I thought perhaps I could keep Anna as a friend, but at a distance. She could be a person I saw once in a blue moon. And this time around, I would do a better job of defining and fortifying my boundaries. I would better know what to expect and to limit the degree of my involvement. A friendship less close, but a friendship just the same. Still, for now, it seemed wiser to lean into my relationship with Anna than to pull away, at least until the reimbursement arrived. We continued communicating mostly through text messaging and occasionally by phone. When we weren't discussing the wire transfer, we spoke as though nothing had changed. The normalcy of our dialogue was reassuring to me. As usual, Anna was propelled by grand notions. She swung from one plan to the next, using her fantastical dreams as fuel. We looked ahead to California and she eyed her next move. Right now I'm planning on being in LA Tuesday afternoon. The conference is over on Thursday lunchtime, Anna said, referencing Recode's annual technology conference, which she wanted to attend. I would arrive on Wednesday night, I told her, and be done with work by 5 p.m. the next day. Okay, sounds good, Anna texted. Maybe we can meet up on Thursday night then. Yes, exactly, it would be fun, I responded. Anna wrote back. Maybe we can go to Doug Aitken's Mirage thing in Palm Springs on Thursday. It's a 2-hour drive, last thing that's still open from Desert X. Anna had mentioned this art piece before, Doug Aitken's Mirage, part of Desert X, a site-specific exhibition in the Coachella Valley that opened in 2017. Mirage was a life-size replica of a suburban American house, nondescript in shape but covered in mirrors, so that each of its exterior surfaces reflected the landscape it faced. You could read about the project on a corresponding website. Mirage is reconfigured as an architectural idea, the seemingly generic suburban home, now devoid of a narrative, its inhabitants, their possessions. This minimal structure now functions entirely in response to the landscape around it. Its familiar architectural form becomes a framing device, a visual echo chamber, endlessly reflecting both the dream of nature as a pure uninhabited state and the pursuit of its conquest. Like a human-scale lens, Mirage works to frame and distort the evolving world outside of it. There is no fixed perspective or correct interpretation. Each experience of this living artwork will be unique. I understood Anna's interest. The installation ticked all of her boxes. It was popular with the right crowd, its impermanence made it timely, and its location made it exclusive. It was the ideal destination for a stylish excursion. We would drive to Palm Springs on Thursday and see the installation on Friday. There were rooms available at the Parker Palm Springs. Anna, there isn't much going on there usually if not a wedding or Coachella. Me, could do 2 nights and fly back Saturday before red eye around 4. Anna, okay, me too, I'm running out of contact lenses after next week, so gotta return to NY. Did she want me to pick them up for her? I offered. No, but I should bring my Polaroid camera. We went through familiar motions as we planned our journey, only this time I was more skeptical of Anna's schemes. Anna, We can also rent a cute car, something classic. A rental car would have made sense for the 2-hour drive from Los Angeles to Palm Springs, but Anna suggesting a cute car further reinforced my disbelief that the trip would happen at all. From there on, I engaged in the fantasy as a sort of test, letting her dream up whatever she wanted just to see what she would do. 3 minutes later, a link appeared. A black Porsche 356 Speedster Tribute with red leather seats. Next up, a white 1971 Pontiac Le Mans. Anna: haha, they actually are available. Not sure you're supposed to drive them for long distances, though. One last link. A 1928 Ford Model A, bright blue. Anna: pull up with the squad, ha ha ha. We were going through the motions, all right. Anna approached possibilities from the top down. The grandest options always came first, affordability be damned. We were striking matches in the rain, and we both knew it. On Wednesday of that week, a few hours before I was leaving for the airport, Anna sent me a text from London, I presumed. I will try to catch a flight to LA later, assuming I'm done with everything. I missed over half that conference now, she said. 2 hours later, she wrote me again. Not going to LA, unfortunately, too much to do, but let's still go to Doug Aitken's thing in a cute car sometime this summer. Okie doke, I replied. I flew to LA that afternoon as planned and took a red eye back home the next day. My rent was due, I was stressed, and there was still no sign of a wire transfer. My anxiety was no longer something I was able to bear on my own. Buckling under the pressure, I confided in Nick. Nick, I gotta tell you something. What's that? For some reason, when we were in Morocco, Anna's credit card stopped working. He waited for me to continue. And I got stuck putting my cards down. Okay. It's a lot of money, a lot of money, I stammered. I mean, she promised to reimburse me, but the wire hasn't come through yet, and it's really stressing me out. Well, that's not good, he said. Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm sure it will be fine. I started to choke up. It's just a lot, and I don't get why there's a delay, and she's still traveling, and I was full on crying now. We sat on the couch and talked through the details. I trust her. It's just a lot. It's a lot, I said. He got up to get me a glass of water, and I followed him into the kitchen. Turning away from the refrigerator, he saw me crying, put down the cup of ice, and held me in his arms. It's only money, Rachel. It just happens to be a lot of it. The way he said this made me laugh. We both knew it was enough money to have real consequences for my life. But still, in this moment, it felt like the kindest thing he could have said. My text to Anna grew increasingly desperate. Hey, lady, do you really think the wire will come through today? I need to mail my rent. Could you do a quick pay for $2,000 so that I can send a rent check without it bouncing? My Amex bills are also due, but they can wait until Monday. To help resolve the issue, Anna put me in touch with Bettina, a woman based in Germany whom Anna described as a family accountant. Bettina would help with an advance on my reimbursement while Anna was still on the road. I initiated a Chase quick pay request as instructed. On June 1st, Anna emailed Bettina about my quick pay request, CCing me. Bettina, has this been finalized? Please also follow through on the wire transfer that's been overdue almost 2 weeks now. Rachel is a personal friend and was kind enough to extend her credit to cover my expenses. Confirm CCing us both ASAP. I emailed a few hours later. Hi, Bettina. Following up on Anna's note, can you please advise? Thank you, Rachel. Anna responded right away. Bettina, it's almost EOD in NY. Make sure this goes through ASAP and forward the successful confirmation to everyone. You have all access to verifications for my accounts, and there are no more reasons for delays. As I mentioned many times before, this is not an invoice that can wait. It's a personal transfer. Contact whoever you need to make this happen now. I am available on my 917 US phone anytime if anything further is needed from me personally. Thanks, AD. 1.5 hours later, Bettina finally wrote back. Anna, apologies for the delay. We submitted everything from our side, and I shall be receiving the bank confirmation shortly. There are no further steps needed to complete this. We will be in touch with all parties as soon as possible. Kind regards, Bettina Wagner. I went through that day and the following as if nothing were wrong. With her wedding only 2 weeks away, my college roommate Kate came into the city for a weekend visit from Amherst, Massachusetts, where she lived. There were no bridesmaids in her wedding, but I served in an unofficial capacity as what she called a can't-do-this-without-you friend. The two of us sat for lunch in the front of Café Mogador on St. Mark's Place, eating Moroccan food and drinking a bottle of French wine. Morocco and France. Was a pattern really there, or was I just seeing things? I suppressed my anxiety. Kate was like a breath of fresh air. Not in spite of my strain, but partially because of it, my time with her felt special. I dove deeper into the joy of our friendship and gave her my full attention. We mapped out the order of her wedding processional. This is a time for Kate, I thought, and I was glad. I held on to my secret. It was beginning to eat me up inside, but I hid it. Aunt Jenny and Janine were in town soon after Kate left, visiting from D.C. and upstate New York. Janine was essentially part of our family. She and Jenny had been friends since they met during a college semester abroad in England, and I'd known her my whole life. She wore silk scarves, red lipstick, and a profusion of sterling silver bracelets that jangled on each arm. The three of us met for dinner on Monday night on the Lower East Side. They were eager to hear about my travels, especially Jenny, who had helped so much with planning my trip in France. I looked forward to filling them in, but at the same time, I made a mental commitment not to tell them about Anna. There was no reason to cause alarm, and I felt uncomfortable disclosing the vacation's cost. That was my intention, anyway. Somewhere between the second glass of wine and the last piece of duck, I casually let it fly. Yes, Marrakesh was great, but a weird thing happened. And there it was. Next thing I knew, I was on my way. I worked overtime as I told the story to instill faith, to give some optimism with all of the dread. And then came the question. How much? Asked Janine. I told them, and they went silent. Do you think there's any chance she could be a con artist? Asked Aunt Jenny. I laughed. Who, Anna? I said. No, not a chance. Looking from the outside in, I get why you'd ask, but no, she's just a mess. I think she's probably distracted, but she'll be back from London any time now, so I'm sure it'll be soon. I swore Jenny and Janine to secrecy, adamant that no one should worry. Anna had been in touch with me that very afternoon. She was still traveling abroad. Someone who had worked for her family for 30 years had just died, she had told me, and she needed to stop by the ceremony in Germany. Can't wait to get back to NY, back to normal, she said. Hang in there, I told her. Calm as I seemed, my brain worked in overdrive to rationalize the delay and scan for solutions. On the Tuesday after that conversation with Jenny and Janine, I woke up tired. As if completing a thought from an interrupted dream, I started my day with a plea to Bettina for news. Dear Bettina, can you please share an update? I am late in my payments as a result of this delay. Please let me know if there is anything I can do to ensure remittance of this payment in the first half of today. Thank you, Rachel. And then a text to Anna for good measure. Anna, I'm really anxious about money. Is everything okay? Can we ask Bettina to make sure it goes through today? My rent check will bounce and I cannot pay my outstanding bills. Following up now, she wrote, Sorry, I'm in a bit of stress. My wallet got lost/stolen. I need to get everything replaced and get on a flight. Your wire has nothing to do with it, though. I will call Bettina again. Sorry for the delay. After sending the texts, I asked Nick for a fast $2,000 loan so that I could avoid a bounced rent check, and he generously provided. Later that same morning, I heard from Casey. Anna's had a rough go of it in Casablanca, she texted. In Casablanca? I thought she was in London. Casey told me that Anna had been at the Four Seasons in Casablanca for 4 nights with no way to pay her bill. When hotel managers came to her room demanding payment and threatening to call the police, Anna called Casey distraught. Casey spoke to the managers and tried to send money, but they were already out of patience and wanted Anna gone. They escorted her from the property. Casey managed to order her a car, and Anna was on her way to the airport. Oh shit, was my reply. I told Casey about La Mamunia. In the end, I put everything on my credit cards and am still waiting on a wire, which I need desperately at this point. Casey, something's not right here. Me, she won't ask her parents for money. Her accountant has been in touch with me. Allegedly, everything will go through today, but I don't feel good about it. Casey, why did she stay in Morocco so long, and alone? Me, no idea. I thought she was going to London. She told me her wallet was stolen. What is this girl doing? Anna was having a problem, that was obvious, but why? and what could be done. Casey and I saw a friend in distress, and we were natural helpers. We agreed that the best course of action was to contact Anna's family, and yet neither of us knew how. She's talked to me about her family, I told Casey. It's just hard to understand the way she speaks sometimes. It can be vague. Early that afternoon, I received an email from Bettina. Dear Rachel, I am awaiting for bank's Y-Room confirmation that I can forge you. You shall be able to track the transfer from your side using it. Regards, Bettina. I wrote back. Dear Bettina, it has been over 2 weeks. Do you expect to receive the Y-Room confirmation today? You did say that I would have it yesterday, along with the successful remittance of payment. I cannot afford any additional delays. Thank you for understanding, Rachel. 2 hours later, with no further reply from Bettina, Anna began texting me about the difficult time she was having. Anna, literally hell of past days. Never traveling again, haha. Me, yikes, I'm so sorry, sounds awful. I'm in a tough situation until this wire goes through. Is everything okay? I don't understand what the delay is with Bettina. Anna, we'll call them again, sorry, craziest day. I'm still at the airport trying to catch a flight and replace all my cards. I feel horrible for putting you in this situation. A few hours later, I heard from Casey. Did Anna wire you the money yet? Me, no, not yet. Casey, she wants me to buy her a ticket back in business class for $2,500. Have you spoken to her yet? This is madness. Me, I texted to be sure she was okay. Casey, and? Me, she's embarrassed about not paying me yet, so wouldn't ask me for help right now because I literally can't pay. I do think she'll pay you back. Did you suggest she ask her parents? I don't know what to say. I hope this is a wake-up call for her. Casey bought the ticket, and Anna arrived to New York the following afternoon. Barely through customs and bound for the Beekman, she texted me, "If you feel like stopping by after work for a bite, you're welcome." We'd come a long way from those days, didn't she realize? Her nonchalance was astounding. "The stress is getting to me," I told her. "Let's do tomorrow if you're free." I was pushing off the commitment with no real intention of following through. "Okay, sure. I will do Casey tomorrow probably if you want to join." Was she testing me or missing our routine? Texting was all I could manage. To see her in person felt like too much. Even so, I was glad that Anna was back in New York and staying in a hotel near my office. Though her connection to my reality seemed tenuous, her physical proximity gave me reason for fresh hope that restitution was on the way.